da 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 da. Coming to you straight from the most reliably biased source on the Matrix, this is the Anarchy in Podcasting Network, and I am Opti. Welcome to the Neo-Anarchist Podcast. And while I have long since left running the shadows to those more brave and desperate, I have been known to jump back into the game for the right price. In this case, the price was the right Mr. Johnson, who I owed a favor to, and his accomplices inside the Arcology. So if you know this Johnson or his accomplice Vox, be sure to throw Biz their way for being such chummers. And lest I forget, I am in the debt of all the little crows who worked that Arcology job in order to get me back where I belong. A hearty greeting from Corvus the Crow Lord. It has been a while, so I feel like I owe you little crows an explanation for where I've been. It's like this. I've been busy, and it's none of your business. But now I have a baby crow who cries too much, a mama crow who's nowhere to be seen, lots of jobs in Bug City, contemplating the inevitable heat death of the universe. You know, good stuff. But Raven has my back and I have yours. Tell Dog he can wait. Loyalty and honor take a second place to truth and knowledge. And that's what you're here for, if I scan you right. So, on with the flow. First, the events that were happening in geopolitics in the not-so-great year of 2055. In January, it seemed as if there were some folks in Yucatan who could no longer fancy being under the bloody thumb of Ozatlan and decided to rebel after a fashion. As it turns out, Ozatlan doesn't like dissent in any of its myriad forms and escalates the violence into a full-scale civil war. It doesn't end for a while. On April 24th, an occupying protest begins in D.C. to advocate for compensation for the lands that the U.S. had given to the Native American nations way back when. Lots of Westerners were forced to relocate to the eastern U.S. and were promised compensation, which they never received, and therefore named themselves the Compensation Army. By late August, the Feds sent troops to shut down the protests. Why, you ask? Well, it turns out there were ulterior motives on both sides. Telestrian was involved, and near the end, so was Shir Terengira and Shir Nanogue. Behind the scenes, the Feds were bargaining over lives, and as conspiracies go, this was a big one, but ultimately settled with a relatively little fanfare. However, my sources tell me that when President Steele met with Lothir, Aeron the Scribe, and other elven reps, it wasn't just compensation and intrigue they discussed. There was also talk of pesticides and containment in a certain Illinois city. On August 8th, the Allied German states declared Berlin a state of emergency due to them simply not liking anarchy. Therefore, they brought in the corporations in order to put an end to the government and corporation-free zone. Was it perfect? No. Was it invaded because of the goodness of AGS's heart? No again. Lots of violence ensues. In November, a joint extraterritorial corporation force uses the paranoia about the bug spirits as a front to stage a massive crackdown on Berlin and take over huge chunks of the state. And on November 24th, Shir Terengira reduces the restrictions around Crater Lake. More on that next time. On the corporation front, Fucci began construction of a deep space outpost on February 13th at the Lagrange Point No. 2. Lagrange Point, by the way, is one of the 5 points relative to 2 space objects that provide a relatively stable orbital point. If you care more about this than I do, please don't write Dear Opti letters to correct me. Damn it, crows, I'm a shaman, not a scientist! In the tech news for 2055, on the last day of the year, rumors consolidated of a new group of folks that came to be known as Otaku. Otaku were children who, even without a cyber deck, could access the Matrix. They spoke about something called the Deep Resonance, and claimed that they were communicating with the spirits of the machine. As they grew and were observed, it became clear that they were not only able to hop into the Matrix unaided, but in many and in even most cases, they were more adept at it than many so-called Deckers. Now, for my money, and I know this is controversial, there is no reason for me to believe that there is anything strange about this. This is magic, folks! I know what you're going to say. You're going to tell me that these otaku, technomancers, whatever, can't use magic, and those who use magic can't seem to do what they do, and you're right. But, do you think that there were water spirits before water formed in the universe? Do you think that there were bug spirits or animal spirits or warrior spirits before those things existed? No. Those things sprung forth out of the collective resonance of the living. And I'm writing a treatment on this, so bear with me, but Magic is born and given form by the life force of the living. Our dreams and emotions and our energy shape it, but it also shapes us. Remember when shamans and mages couldn't pull off each other's spells and such? Almost like it was two different forms of magic? No? Well, I do. It wasn't until more research came in and we discovered that the same basic principles were at work in both that we began to be able to go back and forth and learn from each other. It's still different, but it's also the same. Trust me, folks, the spirits of the machine, although I ain't ever met one, they're real. They're totems for these new kids, and the otaku are the mages and shamans of a new magic. Or not. Who knows? Alright, so let's get to the big story of 2055. And let's be honest, it doesn't really stop in 55. We've been talking on and off about the Universal Brotherhood, the bright shining star in the midst of a world covered with the soot and grime of human greed and ambivalence. They've taken people in, given them food, shelter, purpose, and not asked much in return. Why, back in the day, I had more than a few colleagues I knew who went to them when their jobs were scarce. Was I skeptical? Of course. Doing good for goodness sake is what I tell people to do, not what I actually expect from people. They call me Opti because I believe in a better world, not because I've ever seen it. But hey, who can argue with food, shelter, and a kind word? Well, in March, the UB starts setting up camps called Project Hope. Again, sounds benign, right? My thought was, someone there has a messiah complex and is trying to feed their overly guilt-ridden past with a dose of helping the helpless to balance the scales. Meanwhile, no one notices the correlation that less than 2 months later, the missing persons roster in the UCAS and worldwide, if anybody had cared to check, had skyrocketed. No one who was talking had any idea why. I remember thinking this was strange at the time, but on July 9th, the Universal Brotherhood's camp in Seattle was shut down. The authorities cited health reasons, like it was some dilapidated burger joint or something. Which didn't make any sense to me, because those were the cleanest fragging facilities I'd ever been to. Now, here's what you want. The truth. The truth is that behind the scenes, the UCAS knew what the Universal Brotherhood was already. They found out much earlier in 2055, my sources say even earlier than that, that the Universal Brotherhood was a front for what came to be known as bug spirits, followers of insect totems that, instead of spiritually guiding folks on their own paths, instead possessed them, destroyed their souls, and transformed their bodies into living shells, allowing insect spirits to inhabit our world. They were taking the homeless and the desperate, those who nobody would miss, and filling them up with hope and bug eggs. I know that's not really how it works, but you scan me, nah? When the feds finally decided to act, did they warn us or even tell us what happened? Nah, they wanted the little sheep to continue to eat, drink, and be artificially merry so they could keep quiet and consume. The government even knew that Seattle was just the tip of the iceberg, but barely warned anyone, instead simply trying to quietly take out each cell that they were aware of. Government commando raids on UB cells were called cases of unmotivated terrorist violence. The government tried and succeeded in discrediting and arresting the UB, but not everyone was convinced that the UB was in the wrong. Who could blame them? When the government goes after someone, my first question isn't, what did they do wrong, but what did the government do wrong that they didn't want people to know? But alas, we all found out together. The government was too little too late when it came to Chicago. Ares was investigating the UB in the Windy City, as it was called back then, and discovered a bug hive there, possibly the largest in America, and dispatched a legion of knight-errant troops to lock it down. The knights screwed up, big surprise, and instead sent insect spirits swarming all over the city. In response, the UCAS abandoned the citizens by erecting a huge wall around a huge mass of Chicago, and labeled it the Containment Zone. They made up some bulldreck lie about another VTOS outbreak, and the world bought it. The CZ was completely shut off from the outside. All the Matrix hubs were blown, all the news was censored, and travel in and out was impossible. Word of the Matrix was that an Ares task force was trapped inside the containment zone, and they had set off a small nuke inside the big hive on Cermak Street. Strangely enough, Chicago survived, if you can call it that, because the so-called Cermak blast was mysteriously contained. The next 3 years, however, were not kind. The collapse of the buildings and the ruin that it caused was enough to reduce a once thriving area to ruin and cause civilization to all but break down. Hordes of bug spirits had the run of the place, warlords swooped in, and every Tom, Diana, and Ichabod with a weapon and a complex thought he was the next modern-day Genghis Khan within the walls of the city. The worst part? The nukes didn't even kill the bugs. Just sent them into some kind of sleep. Torpor, I think it was called. No one even went near the site for fear of waking the bugs and having the terror start all over. Of course, that didn't mean runners didn't make some good money climbing into the CZ and finding and exterminating bugs if they were willing to risk life and limb to do it. In December, the UCAS stations two missile frigates and a light carrier in the lake near Chicago, and on December 29th, a leaked document from the shadows lets the world know what really happened in Chicago. The result is a renewed distrust of the government and a new name for Chicago, Bug City. And that's really all I want to say about that for the moment. And now for our Shadowing the Runners segment. Notable shadow runners and famous shadow runs. As always, if you want to learn this stuff from your contacts rather than from me, go away and don't get spoiled. In 2055, there are plenty of runners. You might even consider Ol' Opti to be one of them up-and-comers in the Seattle scene at the time. Still, there were bigger fish than me. One in particular was fairly hard to track any reliable information on, but his name was whispered in the shadows for a long while, and still is. Known to many as the Laughing Man, Dragon Slaughter he is. Last time I'll ever knowingly walk into one of his messes ever again. So, now you know, I'd keep that info close as a way of getting people killed. Finally, for the notable Shadow Run segment. How do you solve a problem like Shodan? It was one of those rare, perfect runs. Every step of our plan went off exactly as intended. Then sirens screamed in the distance and were fast approaching. We looked at one another, and I could read it on everybody's faces. It was time for Plan B. He wasn't there. The Johnson who had sent us on this run and said he would meet us here once it was done to take the target off our hands, he wasn't there. Instead, we were standing in the middle of a street outside a Universal Omnitech facility, carrying the unconscious form of a young girl, some sort of genetic experiment the UO scientists had been working on, and based on the time it had taken us to exfiltrate, liable to wake up at any moment. And if what we had been told was true, that would be a very bad thing indeed. We needed to get off the street before we were spotted. Speed was more important than stealth that close to the facility. We sprinted up the street and around the corner, and as his cyber ears picked up the distant buzz of rotorcraft. He beckoned us to follow him as he charged for a door in the nearest building. There was a muffled gong and a metallic crack, as, dazed from the impact, staggered through the door. Everyone else piled and pushed the door shut, hoping no one looked too closely at the slightly bowed door. The knight-errant cruisers crept up the street. Time slowed to a crawl as a matching set of patrol cars got closer and closer and slowly passed us. They disappeared down the street with the wild howl of their sirens. I told Ihalit to ping the Johnson again on his comm. Nothing. We waited and waited. We had to move, but we had no real extraction plan. Our rigger, Charlie Foxtrot, got separated from us on our way out of the facility. At best, he was just having problems with his comm. At worst, I didn't want to think about it. Ihalit said, "We need to get a vehicle, hotwire something, if we can, not just carjack someone, but we need to buzz before the Dret gets any deeper." She had a way for stating the obvious. Ihalit closed her eyes and started to move her shoulders rhythmically, almost like she was dancing. Slowly, Az started to become translucent, then transparent. Then he almost disappeared altogether. She was starting to look haggard. All the casting she'd done tonight was adding up. "Alright, hoof it down to the street and look for any unlocked cars. If you can't find anything, go see if Charlie's van is still where we left it. Remember, you're not all the way invisible, so stick to the shadows and don't push your luck." The door fluttered slightly as Az made his way out of the building and down the street. The orc, as usual, put in his unwanted but to-the-point 2 cents. "If the Johnson doesn't show, we should geek the girl ASAP. If she wakes up, we might not get the chance." Amiga Joe scowled and said, "That's Drek. Trank patches will do the job." Ihulit added in a worried voice, "She only weighs 60 pounds or so. Another full dose might geek her as well as the bullet." We all looked at the face, who held the comm link that the Johnson would call on. If he called. Plan B was likely to be ugly. Az did his best to stick to the shadows and keep quiet, but quiet was not his forte. Though partially invisible, the spell did nothing to silence the three trash cans and the dirty bum he had kicked out of his way while searching for a vehicle. As one would expect, all the cars he found were locked, but then he hit pay dirt. A Honda Citizen. It was locked up tighter than, something locked up really tight, but it would do. Remembering to bend at the knees and feeling the power of his cyber legs kick in, he lifted the front end of the car and started moving it down the street, wheelbarrow style, to the rest of the team. The face should be able to pop this open in a snap. Being invisible didn't make carrying the car any easier, or any less obvious for that matter, but sometimes acting on your impulses is the best way to stay alive, especially since Az isn't considered a quick thinker by any means, but even he knows time is of the essence. A nearby junkie trying to get cover from the rain in a soy calf box must have thought something went really wrong with his chip as he saw a car move by itself on its two back wheels, illuminated only by the occasional sparks of the bumper hitting the wet concrete. As Az was moving the Honda down the alley, the rotodrone started closing in. He got that old familiar itch on the back of his neck telling him he was being watched. Immediately, he set the front of the car down and dove to the side of the alley into the shadows. Two rotodrones with AK-97s flew up the Honda and stopped. They started looking around the car and both settled on Az. Ihulit had slumped down in the seat of the Honda out of sight. The rotodrone zeroed in on Az and just sat there. Then a small speaker on one of them popped with static and came online. "There you are, Az! Man, I ducked into the restroom to take a leak and came out and you guys were gone! What the drek, man?" "Charlie, you fragging slaughter! When I heard the drones, well, I thought, well, I owe you one in any case." With a growl, Az went back to lugging the car down the alley. Foot tapping, Ihulit just stood there till Az and the car came to a halt. "What was it about unlocked you failed to understand? All that effort pushing that piece of drek here, I guess it never occurred to you to just break the window or pull the door out or something and put it in neutral first." Looking somewhat sheepish, Az just pointed to one of the rotodromes. "Charlie's fault. I got distracted." The rest of the team let out an audible sigh of relief as the drones turned out to belong to their rigger. The tension was still palpable, but the team seemed to relax, if only a little. "Charlie, we're kind of up Drek Creek here without a paddle here, and it's looking like maybe our Johnson isn't going to show. We need an exit strategy. Any chance you got a van rigged up?" Vic was a real talker, true whiz with people, but he could be a little scatterbrained despite his silver tongue. "I think I left my friggin' car tools in the van." Meanwhile, down the street, "The Drek man?" was all the KE officer Dan Rhodes made out as he crept up behind a derelict Ford Americar about 20 meters from whatever was going on here. It may just be random weirdness, but Rhodes' gut told him that something had to do with the kidnapping of the bolo that he had just issued a few hours ago. Rhodes knew that he had seen something, despite what Officer Griggs had said after their first pass-through. Stupid Fragger just wanted to get that soy dog stand before it closed. "Unit 5-7 to Central. Ping for current location, possible code 7 in connection with current bolo. Stand by for feed," he sub-vocalized. Rhodes barely heard Central's reply as his cyber eyes focused on what appeared to be two rotodrones in plane-flipping view, talking to someone in the shadows. AROs instantly popped up in his field of vision as the link was established, and image enhancement software worked to ID the individual trying to stay hidden. As his boosted hearing picked up the muted speech out in the street, and after a moment of clearing out some unwanted background noise, he caught the hushed voice say, "Request immediate backup to my location." Impulsively, Az unholstered the small automatic from beneath his line coat, and masterfully he began painting the ill-illumined street with the fiery red-orange muzzle flash of his TMP. As soon as the other team members were able to assess the situation, they first heard the frightened calls of a knight-errant officer screaming for backup, and then noticed Az moving across the street in a crouched position with his sidearm trained on a squad car. A figure sat patiently in the shadows on a rooftop across the street and surveyed the scene below. A thin wisp of smoke and the dim orange glow of his cigar was the only thing giving away his otherwise obscured position. His crosshair pupils followed the action below and he chuckled to himself in silence. Subvocally, he converses with another party. "I have the team in sight. They appear resourceful. I am curious how they were handled, the authorities." He chuckled to himself again. The other party chirped in the comlink, "Stay close and make sure the product does not come to harm. If you have to geek the team, do it quietly. The figure on the roof shook his head in disappointment. Geez, you think the guy actually thinks he is royalty? The other end abruptly chimed in. I am still listening! The figure on the roof took off his wide-brimmed hat and smoothed his hair back. Sorry, sir. Continuing mission. The figure put his hat back on and sighed. Looks like this is going to be a long night. You got a fraggin' van, or do we gotta run from this bacon? Az said. Charlie smirked at Az and said, waste not, as he pressed a few buttons in augmented reality. The knight-errant sirens were quickly getting louder, and the doors on the Honda unlocked and popped open. Ihulit, Vic, and Amiga Joe climbed into the back. Az helped them lay the girl across their laps while Charlie jacked into the rigger controls. What a fine rig. Should have paid for better security. The moment the cyborg orc got in the front seat, Charlie peeled away from the curb and the tires on the Honda were screeching. Ihulit pulled the gun from her jacket and elbowed Amiga. Couldn't have jacked something with a little bit more room? The crew held on tight as the Honda accelerated dangerously down the dark and rain-slick streets of downtown Seattle. Amiga Joe had hacked into the city grid and was trying frantically to help Charlie plan an optimal escape route, but the blaring sirens of the knight-errant vehicles behind them were unrelenting. Ihulit had been so focused on Joe and Charlie's rapid conversation that he only now noticed the huge metallic tube that Az had been pulling out of his trusty survival bag and was awkwardly sticking out through the broken side window. Drek, she said breathlessly. Is that what I think it is? Probably, muttered Az casually as he settled in, hanging halfway out of the car with the rocket launcher locked onto one of the pursuing KE vehicles, which had just come to in his view. The Honda suddenly jerked and swerved forcefully, and a cacophony of complaints immediately rose up inside the vehicle. As his Vogeljager disappeared into the misty night behind him, the cybered up orc cursed and jabbed Charlie angrily with his heavy combat boot. The frag, man! Forget how to hold the wheel? No, I'm not even... The rigger sounded alarmingly puzzled and worried. I'm not even doing anything! He leaned back in his seat so that everyone could see that not only was the car still accelerating despite Charlie being jacked out and not touching the instruments, all four of its wheels had left the wet asphalt. They were all silent. The girl, who was laying across Vic, Joe, and Ihulit's lap, had opened her black eyes and was staring at them. Over her link, Amiga Joe heard the girl, Shoden, begin a mantra and visibly winced as she looked to the others in the car and linked with them all. Az looked away and started crying. Ihulit shifted her sight to the astral, looking up from the bright glare radiating from the child on her lap and out the back window. She saw a comet-like flash to the street between them and the knight-errant pursuers. In less than half a second, the lead car went from 80 kilometers per hour to flipping end over end with the entire front section pushed into the windshield. Shoden was standing in the middle of the street, chanting, face completely serene, and her eyes were closed. Central to 5-7, be advised, HTR team en route to your location, the dispatcher alerted him over the comm channel. Officer Rhodes had never seen Mojo like this before. He had learned at the academy what people can do with magic. He knew that if he ever caught himself doing something odd, something out of character, that he was to report it immediately and get incensed. Central 5-7, do you copy? Please acknowledge. Dispatch again. Officer Rhodes keyed in, but could not find the words. He knew it was possible for people to stop bullets. He had even seen it. And he knew it was possible for people to lift small objects, including themselves. But he had never seen anyone move a car, let alone one loaded down with six or seven people. 5-7 to Central, he said after a long pause. Central, 5-7, go ahead. Advise, HTR, we have a magical threat. Serious magical threat. I am opening up my visual feed. Officer Rhodes enabled his Cyber Eye Image Link broadcast back to Central Dispatch. This mage or spirit or something is lifting a car with multiple subjects inside, including another mage. Central to Unit 5-7, it'll be okay. Dan, HTR is on its way. Stand down. Just stay out of sight and try not to get hurt, all right? Let the big boys handle this. 5-7, Central, copy. I think. Thanks, Alice. Don't frag with a dragon, eh? Az exasperated. Are we sure she's on our... The Honda's sudden deceleration as it crashed into a skyscraper cut his remarks short. Ihulit started screaming. One might have thought it was because the car started flying, or the vehicles behind them were compressed into half their size, or because they had crashed into a building while flying. But her teammates knew that she was a professional, even under the most dire circumstances. They also knew that her eyes were now milky white and bleeding profusely. Ihulit! What the frag? What's going on? What the frag? 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 Amiga Joe was caught in a loop. In shock, partially due to her brand new Deltaware cyberarm no longer being in one piece, and partially because Iholite was starting to glow a particular shade of purple. Meanwhile, Dr. Garcia shifted his bulk in the ambulance and turned the AC to high. He eyed his teams in various vehicles through the video link as they were going through their pre-checks yet again. Cho fussed with the broken cyber implants, Mick with the thawing corpses, Kronos and friends at their decks, and the mages as they shouted or muttered spells like lunatics, and 10 assorted medics. Amy checked her troops' weapons and munitions, and he hoped she'd brought enough thermite. From his links, he monitored the city emergency channels and the frantic chatter. His was a very specialized dock wagon task force. In the rare event of an activation, they planned diligently for weeks, even up to a year for each mission, in which the Corp and its clients cost a fortune. But for this, they had been given barely 36 hours. It looked like it would be tight, but if the Drek wasn't too bad, he might just pull it off. If he didn't, well, the task force knew the consequences to select friends and family. Just like success brought a generous early Caribbean League retirement. All they had to do was ally with and collect the runners, stabilize their survivors to transport to an undeclared medical facility, help transfer the package, and make the whole scene look like a run gone to Drek. A Drekfest run complete with no survivors, few extra explosions, unidentifiable runner corpses with matching clothes, weapons, and hardware, fake witnesses, bribes, memory alterations, or worse for real witnesses, some key surveillance and data alterations, and a few spells if ordinary chicanery failed. Then escape without suspicion. It might even, no, it would work. It had to. Dr. Garcia mopped his brow and wished he had stuck with wet work. Now, little crows, here is a place at which the story varies, depending on who you ask. So I'm going to give you both, and you can make your own decision. Account 1 has the package continuing to stare blankly upwards at Iholite while the strange purple glow intensifies. After a moment, the girl's eyes close again and her head flops down limply. Within seconds, Iholite begins to speak with a strange warbling intonation, as if the whole process is strange and alien to her. Unfortunate circumstances necessitate a change in destination. You are to deliver me to the back door of Samson's Noodles. You will receive payment and your mageling will return to you. Account 2. I want to go home, she said, her voice an otherworldly whisper. I want to go home now. Az muttered under his breath. Oh, that's just not right. He jammed his hand into one of his pockets, desperately reaching for his narcojet pistol. If he could knock her out again, they might have a chance to get out of this with all their skin intact. The Honda swerved violently as it dove out of the alley, causing the big orc to drop the pistol as he reached hastily for a handhold. The pistol dropped to the car's floorboard as it made an impossible right turn. Please don't do that again, she said to the orc. Are you doing this? Charlie asked, trying his best not to let panic into his voice. She nodded. I don't suppose you could stop now, could you? She shook her head. I want to go home now. Iholite and Joe looked at each other. I think, Joe said, that sounds like a fantastic idea. Now, I've been told that the crew remember this very differently, and I reckon that the runners themselves don't even remember it the same way twice. Point is, some thought the girl Shoden was pulling the strings. Others heard her crying out for help. What is consistent, though, is that the runners did an about-face and began heading towards Samson's Noodles. Once there, it was an epic pileup of misfortune. The police triangulated their position based on a few cops that had seen them change direction. The dock wagons were hot in pursuit of the runners to rendezvous and make good on their contract, and the two groups of cops and dock wagons slammed into each other just right outside of Samson's, just as a sniper bullet fired off towards Iholite's head. The pileup of the knight-errant and dock wagons was not the fault of either of the drivers, but Shodan's instinct for self-preservation was kicking in. As the docks and the cops were crawling out of their vehicles, or trying to, the sniper bullet remained where it had been for the last few moments. It was suspended in front of Iholite's face, while Shodan, operating both the limp body they had taken and Iholite's body simultaneously, scanned for the assassin. Homing in with unnatural senses, the bullet returned to its giver and gave him the gift of blindness in his remaining fleshy eye. Inside Samson's, a husband and wife cowered. They had heard the commotion and were ducking behind the countertops for safety. Mom? Dad? The little girl groaned. Sweetheart? The mother exclaimed as she embraced the fatigued little girl that we had extracted. Where did you find her? Thank you for bringing her back. It was at that moment we realized that our payday was in danger of becoming a charity case. But for some reason, we all seemed very frosty with that. As we left Samson's, we looked over the pileup outside. The knight-errant boys and the crew of the capitalist ambulances had been taken away by another dock wagon, which had arrived for no apparent reason. No bystanders seemed to be very bothered by the commotion, and a few weeks later, as we were discussing the case, we drove by Samson's Noodles to case out what was happening with our unwitting cargo since, but we weren't able to. None of us could remember where Samson's Noodles was, and we couldn't find it on our matrix or anywhere else. Had we imagined it? Had we been unable to find it again because of magic? Had it completely disappeared? We don't know. What we do know is that the sixth member of our crew, some upstart shaman, took off soon after. We can't remember what his name was, though. We can't even remember what he looked like. All we can agree on is that the crows were crowing awfully loudly that day. There it is! Word has it, chummers, that Shodan lives a happy life selling noodles with her folks. And whether they know it or not, the runners got a reward better than money that day. By the way, if you like noodles, and if you can find it, Samson's is the best. Speaking of the best, you little crows are the best audience in the shadows. I couldn't wish for a more active and attentive audience. Seriously, all eight of you warm my heart. But let's grow together. Tell your chummers. Start a neo-anarchist cell in your city today. Let me hook you up with all the best Johnsons to run for. You know, podcasting in the sixth world ain't cheap. Perhaps I'll do a fundraising event. Neo-Anarchist Podcast Radio, NAPR, funded by listeners like you. Stay tuned. Actually, don't stay tuned. It's time for you and I to part ways, because you have already wasted an entirely good slot of time listening to the Anarchy and Podcasting Network. The music serving as the background to Audible Anarchy was written by the legend Marshall Parker and reimagined by Unanimium 88. This was the Neo-Anarchist Podcast, and I am Opti, the abominable, adorable, angry, and agile apex ape, aging aimlessly adrift among ample areas, arching arduously, allowing anarchy to awaken. Enjoy your freedom, and remember, like all life, freedom is precious and very fragile, so hold it and the ones you love close, and whisper to them, Opti is my shaman.